245.
Well, Charles and I would love to welcome you. We are passionate about our hobbies beekeeping. We have been for 42 years, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that later on. I first would like to also tell you that we do have, every single day, we'll have a little different display in the back. Today, because we're going to be doing the history of beekeeping, that round table has a little bit of that. We do have some of our professional magazines, American Bee Journal, the American Bee Journal, that is there, and we would invite you to take those on Friday home with you, because we certainly don't want to take them on the plane again, to be honest with you. In fact, when I'm talking about that, this didn't come on the plane with us either. We came out of Chicago. Actually, we came out of Minneapolis-St. Paul. But we were kind, we had a man kind enough over in Bellingham, Washington, who let us have this for the week. And we picked it up in Bellingham, Washington, and we'll drop it off again there. And when loading it onto the ferry, or whatever you call that little transport that we were on, the man wanted to be assured that there were no bees in it. So we were happy to tell him that. Well, let me first of all tell you a little bit about what I was reading, and I'd like to tell you a story about that. As I was reading this book in our chalet yesterday, I read this. Holden is also one of the few church-related organizations with the word humor in its article of incorporation. Sometimes working with bees and honey production is humorous. So picture the following. This little girl was 3 years old at one time, and her little pediatrician, Dr. Granger, loved honey. She said to me, every single time you bring the girls in for an examination, bring me a jar of honey, please. So little three-year-old Carla went with me for her three-year-old examination, and I brought a 5-pound jar of honey. That's almost a half a gallon. You can kind of see what it looks like back there, far right. Except, of course, it's much larger, almost a half a gallon. I set Carla on the examining table, honey on the examining table. You know where I'm going, don't you?
Oh, no.
The nurse assistant came in and said, does a doctor really want that large of a sample? And so we are. Well, our first thing that we're going to talk about today is how we got started. Picture Chuck and picture me back in 1971. We had graduated college. I think you'll know what I'm talking about. We were pacifists. You know what it was like back in the Vietnam War. We were hippies. We wanted to live off the land. We wanted to have our babies naturally, and you know, all the breastfeeding deal and everything like that. We didn't want TVs. We only wanted one car. We wanted to eschew all the materialism of our parents. We wanted to live simply. And so Chuck was in the dental office at one time reading Mother Earth News. And he read about beekeeping. And he said, oh, I remember when I was a kid, my dad had some bees. We grew up in Racine, Wisconsin, both of us did. And didn't meet, by the way, until we went off to school. But nevertheless, his dad was not really a beekeeper, but a bee paler. What happened when his dad would go out and extract the honey is he would take the honey off, he would dress in layers and layers and layers of clothes, take the honey off, put it in a wheelbarrow, and run up the hill like crazy with a big swarm of bees following him. So you know very well that when those bees died one winter, he did not replenish them. But he did put the hives in the old chicken coop. The chickens weren't in there anymore. And so he had these hives stored for years and years and years. So here we were in 1971. Chuck called his dad, do you still have the hives in the chicken coop? Indeed, I do. And so we went up there one time. And in 1971, there weren't all the books that there are today. But he was fortunate enough to have his father's cousin, who was an older man, his father's age, a beekeeper, who kind of mentored us at that time. Now, we were living 2 hours away in the northern suburb of Chicago. And so we would just drive up every other weekend and keep the bees. And Chuck was kind of a good salesperson. The first year that we had the two hives of bees, immediately he had all the honey sold. And so he said, let me get 4 hives next year. Okay. The next year, we must have 8 hives. Okay. Well, at one time we had been convinced to have It has been a wonderful, wonderful hobby. We were teachers, our professional years of teaching. And this was perfect for beekeeping because we were able to keep the bees in the summer and work them all the time. And they really only had the hard times maybe in May and in September when we had two jobs there. And so that was pretty much it. So have I left anything out about the how we got into beekeeping?
No, she's pretty accurate. I'd like to expound on a few other things. How much I'm enjoying this to be in a way of the email. Cell phones. Mm-hmm. And back to like we used to want to live in 1971. And I imagine a lot of people going back, young people say, oh my gosh, I can't hardly wait to get our ass into all those modern electronics.
I'm also happy.
But, I have this feeling today with people so digitally hooked up that people don't have a life anymore. They're ruled by the electronics. And I wonder if they ever have any introspect time to look into their own soul. Without all this stuff, this all this is coming at them from all directions, and all these coming to us, all this electronic gadget. So anyways, we're very basic and simple people. That's how we got started beekeeping. Not that we don't have all those electronic conveniences. We have all those things today, as much as she and I are aging to have. But I'm really enjoying it up here because we're away from that. I don't know how many people have read in scripture about honey and honeybees, but there's at least 40 different scripture passages about honeybees in the Bible. Mankind was created by our great creator. If you go through the days of what he created each day, God created each day. You'll know that one day the birds of the air, flowers of the field were created. Well, honeybees, and I don't know if there's any, I haven't read it in detail, honeybees were co-evolved with flowers because flowers were dependent upon these insects for pollination. So it all was intertwined together. And because of this, today we, one third of the food that we eat daily is credible to honeybees. Okay? So I think it won't take a, every time you put a spoon of food in your mouth, you think about the third spoon that has to do with honeybees. You know, everything from raisins, to cherries, to beautiful peaches in the cafeteria, even carrots. Anybody ever Oregon? The biggest carrot-producing state in the country as far as carrot seed. And you need honeybees to pollinate it. You wouldn't have those nice little crisp stalks of carrots you take with you. And all those melons and the cucumbers and the pumpkins and the squash and all the fruits we take for granted, all the little honeybees. They need bees to pollinate those crops. That's the real big thing. Honey's just a byproduct. But the food we eat is so dependent upon it. How would you like to have a diet where you just would be able to eat grains? Grains are good for you, aren't they? But would you like to have it 24/7, 3 a day? They don't need bees. Grains are wind pollinated. But most of the other flower plants that have flowers need to have that pollen transferred from flower to flower to be able to produce a fruit or a seed. From the almond nut, California, to the peach up here in Washington. So anyways, I'm going to read just a couple passages. We're going to open a couple of these each day. The honeybee is known the world over for its industrious production of honey. It is the symbol of work, creative activity, busyness, cooperation, obedience, orderliness, employees, and diligence. The phrase, as busy as a bee, is commonly heard. The honey it produces is a symbol of wisdom, rebirth, and positive changes in spiritual or moral direction and temperament. John the Baptist came eating only locusts and wild honey, showing his reliance upon God's providence in nature rather than on man. The resurrected Christ proved to his disciples that he was not a ghost by eating a bit of honey from Luke 24, verse 42. Because of the sweetness it produces, the bee is an emblem of Christ, even through it. Though his words may sting the sinner, the stinging reinforces the image of Christ, bee who is the religious judge. The bee's ceaseless activity surrounding the production of honey is comparable to the constant action of the Spirit of Christ hovering about in the church. Okay? Those are a couple of them. We'll read a few each day. But so that gives you a little bit about biblical passages. Now, exactly where, you know, the honeybees that we have, we're going to talk about, whenever we say bees, we're referring to one kind of bee. It's the honeybee. trees cut short. Bees, wasps, and hornets belong to a species known as Hymenoptera, and most of those have stingers to protect themselves, to protect their nest site. Honeybees, the same thing. Today, though, through constant breeding and constant work with bee breeders and puppies, we've bred a lot of the meanness out of honeybees. Except, we haven't been able to attack the issue with the Africanized honeybee, which we find in our southwestern states. And that is a problem. If you live in, anybody here go to Arizona in the winter? Or been in Arizona? You know, you open up the yellow pages of the phone book and you look for bees, there's three pages of the yellow pages of just people that eradicate honeybees. Because they have the vicious traits, these Africanized honeybees. You don't have them here up in the North Country. But they are around. But the bees that we work with today are quite gentle through selective breeding. And bees originally came into this country. They're not native to North America. Honeybees are not native to North America. They came in about 1611. They believe they came from the Jamestown colonies. At that time, sugar had to be brought over from England. It was very expensive. And the early white settlers had not learned how to make maple sugar from the Native Americans. Plus, maple trees don't grow in South Carolina, and it didn't very well. And so the bees provided a sweetness that the early settlers and colonists could use. And it's written in detail that about 1640, they were up and down the East Coast. How do bees expand their colonies, you think? Do you want to look at that chart over there? When bees get crowded and want to make a new family, they do something called swarming. It's a natural thing that they do. And most beekeepers try to prevent this. We're trying to prevent something that's a natural thing, because when a swarm of bees gathers together and flies away, the honey crop that I would expect from that beehive is going to fly away with it. They will go look for a new nesting site. And if they can find a nice hollow tree, avoid it in your side of your house where a knothole got out, popped out. They like spots where they get in because they got to have their house in a dark environment. Okay? They don't nest in the open light of the outdoors. So anyways, so then the early settlers came along and we started having this, you know, this manifest destiny moving westward. Most of that was done by canal boats, railroads, and then we got to the Mississippi. We didn't have railroads yet. And so covered wagons were the main avenue of traffic movement to the people to get to, you know, heard about the Oregon Trail and so forth. Most of that started in the St. Louis area and moved out to the West Coast. And beehives were brought along. Well, those days, beehives were not kept in boxes like this. They were kept in straw containers called skeps. And they were kept in a wagon, in the wagon train, probably next to the chuck wagon or the where they carried all the utensils and the hardware that the early settlers needed. And so often these colonies would swarm out of these straw hives and live in the forest. And the Native Americans soon found out that they had never seen these insects before, but they understood one thing, that they were stinging insects. And so they start calling them white man's flies in the Native tribal tongue. So anyways, that's how our bees got to the West Coast. Some of them came all the way down around the Cape in South America by boat and brought up into California into the early missions. The early beekeepers in the United States were run by monks in the monasteries, and especially in the western states like California, where we have a lot of missions that were established. And even, that refers even back to England and Germany. A lot of those early honeybees were maintained in monasteries, and they made some of the first skeps, the brothers in those monasteries. There was one brother or a couple of brothers who would be just in charge of that. So anyways, that's a little bit about how the bees came to arrive throughout our continent, spread throughout the continent. Now we're going to take some breaks. We're going to try to talk about 45 minutes, maybe 15 minutes for questions at the end. But we can take some breaks. We're having some problems with our video.
We're getting there.
Getting there. Okay.
Yeah, getting
sorry
there.
About that.
The other alternative is I do have it in Keynote and I do have it here.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, anyways, we're. You want to add something at this time? We're going to go to the chart.
Okay, I think I do have something, yes. When you see this little PowerPoint that we have today, I think it's 46 slides of items that you need to start beekeeping. You really don't need all those things to start beekeeping. You can start very, very with a minimum of things. In fact, here we are minimalists telling you you need 46 different things. That's not the case. Basically, you need a hive, you need the bees, and you need something to protect yourself. And then eventually you're going to need something to extract that honey and make it usable to your family. But these things can be purchased used, they can be purchased new, and you know, they are not extremely, extremely expensive. How much do you think it would cost to start a hive of bees with the outfit on and the
everything bales? Brand new?
Okay, everything brand new.
$350 to $400.
Okay. Now, we do not...
Unless you buy things used. It's like buying a used car. You're not going to pay the price of a new car, cost you. So I always tell people, if you know another beekeeper, or there's a beekeeping club in the area, get information from them, because sometimes that's where you can get the best deal. Plus, you can have some mentoring done by some people in the beekeeping area. Out here in the West Coast, I know there's a lot of beekeeping clubs in Seattle, Portland. Most towns of any size would have, or on a county-wide basis, would have beekeeping clubs. Beekeepers are really interested in helping out other people get started. You know, because it's a dying craft. And you know, it's trying to get young people involved with it. It's difficult. Question here.
Have you ever used the, I don't know what to call it, the long
top
style?
Bar hive. Yes,
the question is, have you ever used a top bar hive? Why don't you explain what it is?
Top bar hive is really known as the Kenyan hive. They originated in Kenya, where they hang them in the trees to collect swarms. They're a very low maintenance type of hive. They don't lend themselves to commercial production of honey. Since a lot of the honey can be harvested, you have a difficult time saving a lot of bees. They don't, in our area of the Midwest, where we live, they don't winter well because of how all the combs are positioned in the hive. We have to have our boxes stacked up on top of these because the bees start in the bottom, and through the winter they eat up into the larder of honey. Bees only make honey so they can survive the winter. They're hoarders. And in the Midwest, we in the North Country, you know, 6 to 8 months of cold weather and only 4 months of summer. The bees got to do all this work in 4 months to put enough up in that in their pantry to be able to survive the winter. That's their lifeblood. That's the fuel for their furnace. That's what keeps them going. And so they need to do that. Everything, the bees are so programmed. This is what, you know, I've been a Lutheran all my life and believe in the great creator, but when you become a beekeeper, you really, really understand what this whole creation is about. How these intricate little insects can be so programmed to do this job, that job, that job, through their entire lifetime until they die, and they give their lives to the calendar. And everybody has a job to do, nobody gets out of line. They can't jump from one job to the next because they're programmed to do this job through their life cycle. And everything works in harmony in a beehive. And that's what's so beautiful about the whole place. When you get into the hive, you just forget about everything that you, every problem you've had that day, you become engrossed in what you're looking at and what you're doing. So anyways, that's what's so interesting about bees, I think, that it's caught my imagination. I teach classes in beekeeping. We can't teach you how to be a beekeeper in 5 hours. I teach classes in beekeeping in the Chicago suburban area. We run an 8-week class for beginning beekeepers, 2 hours a night for 8 weeks. And we get them all, they learn how to build their equipment. We order the package bees, we get all of our cages, and we'll show you those tomorrow in the video. We get all of our cages of bees, we buy them screened in boxes from California or the southern states, the Gulf states. They have to come, because they have to come from a warm climate early in the year. We like to get our bees early in the year, so they have a good chance of storing up a lot of honey through the summer months. And it was, so we give them the whole ball thing. And then we have field days where they actually come out. And we call them the way we call placement TPs, is known as an apiary or a bee yard. In layman's terms, it's easier to say bee yard. I am an apiarist, or in common terms, a beekeeper. Throw somebody, the scientific thing is apiary. Okay? Apiarist. But anyways, so that's how, you know, that's basically what we do. We help the people. I just finished last week a honey harvesting workshop. We went out to the beehives that we actually installed bees in back in April, and we had all the surplus honey was on the hive. This is the culmination of the summer. And we took them all out there and we showed them how to remove the honeybees from the hive so that we wouldn't bring them all back home with us when we harvested the honey, extracted it. And we did this at a farm park over there where they have facilities to do this, and it was a very rewarding. Everybody went home with a little 8-ounce jar of honey. They saw how to, they had to uncap the frames, take off the cappings, they had to put it in the centrifuge. We're going to show you that equipment in our videos coming up. They had to spin the honey out, they had to strain the honey, and then they had to bottle the honey. So they all went home with an 8-ounce jar of honey that day. From hive to jar in about 3 hours. Can't get fresher than that. And I mean, they felt really rewarded. It was a small fee for the course. I think we charged $12 or $15. But it was very well received. I couldn't believe it. You know, people, I had people that didn't even take my classes. They said, you know, it was written in the Park District book. He said, let's go see what that's about. Now they've signed up for my class for next year. They really got caught up in this whole thing of how honey is manufactured and produced. So how are we doing?
For some reason, it was behaving an hour and a half ago, and now it's not. So we apologize.
And you think to see, it must be the in focus, am I correct?
We can get
otherwise, we can just do it with the CD here.
It's not the CD, though, it's the projector thing. But can you use some of your props that you brought?
Yes.
Google.
Okay.
Can you guys mess with the refresh rate on the monitor?
It has nothing to do with that.
It's how this is projecting something that's not visible from this screen. It assumes another part.
Yes, because that's not even my... Mm-hmm. Okay, now.
All this technology.
We're not getting it.
What was the refresh rate you mentioned?
It's like you're having rasterizing problems.
Yeah, I saw that.
Refresh rate. If you go into monitors, there's a couple of like 50 hertz or 60 hertz. Yeah, actually, on the Mac, if you go into the control panel and hit monitors, it should be in there.
You know, the other thing we can do is we can just make that accessible for, you know, we just hold that up high on that little podium there and people can see it on the screen, Scott.
System preferences.
Is it monitors or displays?
And if you are refresh rate under 62 hertz, if you toggle that down something lower, sometimes you have better reactions to it.
Well, it's interesting because we're not getting the same display as that. So go over here. Yeah, go over there so you can select the refresh rate. The refresh rate. There you go.
And what do you think it should be at?
We'll try something.
Takes a village.
Know exactly the,
Jeff, why don't we move this up front and at least, you know, we can show...
For this stuff?
No, for this. At least it'll have a small screen.
See, 60 looks better than 62.
It's better than that.
Yeah. Let's see what we have. We'll give a couple points.
And then in displays, you can also unmirror those, which should produce the same image on the laptop and on the screen.
You mind coming over
here? Try to move and mess it up.
Sounds like you've got some knowledge.
Well, let's address it while they're working on it.
That's what I said.
If it doesn't work within a few minutes, we will put the podium up here and show you the pictures just on the small screen here.
We'll talk about these hives right now, the stuff we have here. I'm really happy to have this equipment because of the fact that we couldn't have Paul Archer in Minneapolis. Stuff that I show has never been used before. Christine, his, you know, classroom stuff. Has never had bees in it. This has had bees in it.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to start with a couple of tools, first of all. Every beekeeper needs one of these, a smoker. Now, we don't know why, but bees, when they smell smoke, they go deep into the hive, they start engorging themselves on honey. We don't know exactly what it is. The theory is this, is that when bees live in hollow trees in the forest, their native home, every so often we would have lightning strikes, but we'd have a forest fire. And when bees smell smoke, they know through eons of time, they have to leave their nesting site. To find a new nesting site, they have to fly away from the fire, and they go into an engorging food cycle where they eat as much honey as they can get into their gut. So they have the strength and stamina to fly away from the fire. Find a new home, and then build a new nest. Now, if you happen to have a beehive in the woods that's unoccupied, bees will move into an empty beehive. I put these out in my beehive every year to try to capture something. It entices bees. It comes up my old equipment. Because then I don't lose the Golden Hollow tree. There's no way I'm gonna make any money off of these. I'm not gonna go get top time up a ladder and tree and get them out of the tree. So
okay, I think we're ready to go.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks for all the help.
Yes. Okay. Now remember, all of this is not needed at first when we start. So let's go ahead.
We're gonna kind of race through the stuff.
Now the IPM bottom board is something that's just come into use recently because of our insect problems that we have. It is a screened bottom board that lets the little mite fall off the bottom, the body of the hive, of the bee, I should say. We highly recommend that you get something like that. An IPM in the Midwest also has a masonite piece here that goes in here to slide in to keep those winter winds from coming up. Mm-hmm. Okay.
We'll talk more about mites in the last one of our last meeting because we have bees aren't free of disease in mites. They're just like humans. They have maladies that they can get. So we have that type of bottom board, or we have another type, which I don't, we're trying to get away from this bottom board. It's a solid wood one. It's heavier, and mites can fall down in here and come back on a bee coming in from the field and reattach itself. So basically what we want to do is we want to try to go, I teach everybody to go to the screen bottoms today. Okay?
Okay, the two deep brood boxes are what we use in the Midwest if you are strong. Now, Chuck teaches women also.
Or also strong.
And we men.
I'm not as strong as he is.
I have women that are stronger than men in my class.
But so sometimes as you get older or as you are perhaps not as strong as some men are strong, you might want to use only a medium depth, which we'll be showing later on. But these deep ones like this are great because they provide ample room for the queen to have all of her eggs stored.
And the shore will be there to store the honey.
They store it in here, these frames, and again, we're gonna use these terms. This is why we're going through this today. Each of these individual ones, could you pull the frame out, please, are called frames, and this is where the queen lays her eggs. It does get dark after a few years. In fact, it is recommended to us that we change our wax every 5 years.
Can you turn the bat lights on?
But this is not here for any honey storage at all. This is all for brood.
Now this is a comb, and we put a starter in this frame. Starters look like.
Side. And we're going to just pass this around. This side is already starting to be drawn. We'll talk more about how they draw wax later on.
That frame has a foundation sheet in it that is embossed with a honeycomb pattern, a six-sided hexagon cell. And then the bees get onto that, they pull little bits of wax off their wax glands about the size of fish gills, and then they put them in their mandibles. And they extrude them onto that pattern and they make cells out of that. This is one that's already been done, and you can see it's already had babies raised in it, and it's already getting dark. And we call that travel stain. When bees come into the hive, they have no rug to wipe their feet. So they bring in pollen, and their feet can be dirty, and over all that, like you're carpeting your house. You have travel stain in your apartments, don't you? Well, you don't take your shoes off where you walk a lot? Well, the bees have the same thing. So this frame, it's still a good frame. It's got nice comb patterns. We'll use this. I put this in the hive. Got lots of great bee smell. And we'll pass that
one
around.
One of the things I'd like to point out to you is the entrance here. And you'll notice, Chuck, did you point out the entrance?
Here.
That is normally where they go in and out. We'll show you about an entrance reducer later on. You might wonder what these two holes are. In the Midwest, we have snow once in a while that covers this. So they can't get in and out of here. So we put these holes in so that in the wintertime they can come and go through these holes and not come and go through here. Another reason that we're going to talk about very shortly about reducing that entrance is mice. And another reason, of course, is all the dead bees in the winter fall down there, and sometimes they get to be an inch and a half thick too. This enables the bees to come and go in the winter.
And in the winter, do you close up that bottom?
Yes, and we will be showing that to you shortly.
We close that bottom one there in the winter because a mouse can jump and get in there. Mice love to move into beehives. Cozy, warm, and a food supply. So mice are the dirtiest little critters there are, the bees. We do everything we can in our power to keep mice out of our eyes. Okay? So the upper hole is always open for ventilation.
Do we have an inner cover? Okay. An inner cover would be like our ceiling here. It is basically it gives access for you to listen or at least look in. It gives access for you to feed if you have to in the wintertime. And it also gives a little bit of space where you are able to do
the bees can gather up here. They can gather up here around here. If it gets too cold below, they can come up here and gather. We can also do some supplementary feeding up here. We want to give the bees some pollen, extra pollen. We want to give them a boost. We can do some boosting here by adding some of this. We do have to, in the northern climates, we do have to feed our bees sugar syrup for starters. Once the flowers come out, they refuse to take syrup. They only want the real genuine stuff. They want flowers, okay? So you can just tell when they're starting to take nectar from flowers, okay?
Okay, next one, Carla. Okay.
This is a telescoping outer cover. Keeps the weather out of the hive. It laps down over the edge. Out in California, there's a California cover that is not equipped with metal because they don't have the rains in California. And it might even stretch up here along the coast. They're not always metal covers. What about it?
Lots of rain.
But they have what's called a California cover. It's a little cheaper made, but we in the Midwest, we got to have good protection.
And this is like a roof of a house.
That's like a roof of a house.
Okay. Now remember what I was saying about if you are to the point in your life where you don't want to carry these really heavy, deep brood boxes. We do have women and older people like we are right now who, instead of doing the brood in, let's say, two of these, will do maybe a medium depth, three of those for the brood.
That's a medium depth.
Yes.
So if you use that deep one, when the bees have finished their work and it's full of honey, what's the estimated weight of that?
About 75 to 80 pounds.
The only thing is this deep one does not usually have honey in it. We hope that it's going to have mainly brood and just a little bit of honey on the outside of those frames for feeding and also pollen.
Brood doesn't weigh that much. When I say brood, it's all the stages of a bee's development into an adult. Mm-hmm. Egg, larvae, pupae, and then hatches out as an adult. Well, so it's that, anybody know what that process is called in high school? Science. Metamorphosis. Learn that word. Metamorphosis. All insects go through it. Okay? Okay.
Now this, we might have to have the last lights turned off because there are several types of foundation. Well, it's a little touchy to see, isn't it? There is pure wax foundation. The pure wax foundation, this is really touchy to see here now, is mainly used for, if it's a very, very thin one, for cut comb honey. We also have a wax foundation that is wired, and that can be used then in wired frame. Chuck, the one that was passed around, what is that one? Can you tell?
This I think was Plastisil.
Oh, okay. That's what I was going to show you up here. We have something called Plastisil. It is plastic with a little bit of a beeswax coating over the top of it. And without the beeswax coating, the bees would have absolutely nothing to do. And so the beeswax coating helps them to accept it more. However, given the choice between one or the other, they definitely choose the one that is pure beeswax. That's okay. And then, as I showed you, the wire ones. These are really, really important for hot weather where wax can have a tendency to warp.
This hive uses all medium depth supers. In other words, it's all this size supers. This is the type we're trying to steer people towards this today because each of these boxes, instead of weighing 75 to 80 pounds, weighs 40 to 45 pounds. And people are much more capable of lifting this size box. The bees do the same thing. We save the bottom three for the family, for brood rearing. And then the upper two or three, depending on the colony, will be used for honey storage. Okay? We never touch any. The bees will put honey in here also, okay? And as we go into the fall or winter, we want this upper box right here to be solid honey, and probably this one half full. We want our bees to start the winter down here, Because bees will only move up in the winter, they move up into their stash of honey. They won't go down, they don't like to move side to side in a cold climate. They just want to power straight up. Now, if the colony's a big colony and it can expand on warm days, it can go on bringing honey into the outer reaches of that hive, into the cluster. Because bees cluster in the winter. They don't hibernate. They stay alive. They barely move. But they're able to maintain heat in the hive by vibrating their wings. They eat honey, and they vibrate their wings. They share a little bit, a tiny bit of body heat with each other. And this is a rotating mass the size of a soccer to the size of a basketball. Right in the middle is the queen bee. Okay? And she has to be kept 10 below out here, or 100 out here. In there by her, she's already about 85. Cooled or heated to around 85 degrees year round. They can do this. They can have this heat sink set up. As long as they have that fuel, they're able to eat honey. They're able to keep that heat going.
Yes, I'm curious why you don't put them in a heated place.
And we will talk about that when it comes to winter management, if that's okay.
They're doing a lot of canopy.
Yes. Like root cellars, yeah. Everything, yes. I do want you to make...
Well, now I just want to make one comment on that. Because McDonald's, you all know about McDonald's fries, right?
Yeah.
Okay. They're wintered in Idaho in what they call potato cellars. As soon as those potatoes come out, what do you think goes into those cellars? Beehives.
Oh my God.
They've got contracts with beekeepers to move beehives into those cellars because they're vacant. The temperature is kind of below ground or whatever. It's into a berm. So it's about 40 degrees. 40 degrees is the very best temperature to winter bees in because they consume very little honey. And the building has to be kept dark. Because you don't want your bees to fly in the winter any more than they have to. They should get out once in a while and make a cleansing flight if they're outdoors. But indoors, since they're not eating a lot of honey, they don't have to go to the bathroom very often. They're controlled by what they eat, how much they eat. In the winter, we hope for January thaws in the Midwest, so our bees can take off, make a quick flight, because bees only defecate on the flight, on the wing. Come back to the hive, make it back in, and go about their business of keeping the queen warm and keeping the colonies alive.
May I make one other thing? One of the beauties of having a 5-story hive with all the same size frames is that they can be interchangeable, which is kind of nice. You know, whereas you can't with a deep and a shallow.
We can't hold like these.
Here. See, it won't work.
Is there a gap between the bottom three and the top?
I do want to show you this. In fact, make a mental note of this right now because we're going to be showing you what that is. But see how it looks. Okay, let's go on to the next one.
There it is.
Okay, Charles, do you
have a
queen spot in there?
Yeah,
you do. Yes.
Sorry about this finding pristine, but this one used. Mm-hmm. It's a grid. What do you think this grid is put in there for?
Apparently, it's a queen excluder.
Right. Very good. The queen is a little fatter than all the worker bees, and she can't get through this grid. She can squeeze and try and lose a little weight, but she isn't going to make it through here. So we confine her to the lower sections of the hive where we allow her to raise all her family, as many as she wants, the more the merrier. We want our bee colonies to be 60,000 to 80,000 bees in the prime of summer. And with that, I know I'm going to get a good honey crop. Okay? So this is the queen spider. Now, the bees they don't only make wax, they make a resinous material that is used for weatherproofing. And if you took a walk through the woods here recently, you know the poplar trees, you know that pungent smell? It's a smell walking down here towards the labyrinth. Well, you can smell it. Smell this. It smells the same way. Because bees collect especially off of poplar trees. Late in the summer, the poplar leaves exude a kind of a sap. It's sticky stuff. The bees will go out and collect it on their back feet, bring it back to the hive, and start weatherproofing their hives. Okay? And so I'll pass this one around. And you can take a whiff of it if you want. That's a queen excluder.
Okay, now this is another one that we probably should have the light off. This is called a Boardman front feeder. In the Midwest, we can't use this. The reason we can't use it is because it is so cold in the Midwest that the bees cannot come down here, come out, and get the nectar. This is actually sugar syrup, by the way.
Actually, from the inside.
But they cannot, I mean, because remember, all of these things here, perhaps, could be filled with dead bees. And so they simply can't do that. And so, but this is one, you know, one way that you can feed bees. Let's go to another one. Go ahead, John.
This is kind of feeders that we use, a pail feeder. We mix up sugar syrup, one to one ratio. And this one's got some, I got this from the health food store. They buy these health powders in it for making health drinks. I just punched a few nail holes that are very fine nail holes. This one has some little drill holes all around the edge, about 10. And when we invert that, little drops of syrup will come to the hole. And then the bees gather it. Their tongue is called a proboscis. They'll stick their proboscis, their hollow soda straw tongue in there, and draw down one drop at a time. And they begin to festoon underneath it, and they begin to bring that syrup down, and they share the wealth of that meal. It allows their wax glands to work, because they need supplemental feeding for getting their wax glands to work. It allows them to make comb and to feed each other and feed the queen. All through that process of that, these are all the ways you start the colonies. These are not out in the summertime when the flowers are blooming. Okay, next one.
So that's inverted on
that's inverted, yeah,
under a tray or something?
Or? Right over that inner cover hole. I put a couple pieces of lath here and here, and then turn that jar over. Now that will drip just for a couple seconds, and it'll airlock. And then the only way they can get drips to come through is when they pull as many drips out as they can, and the thing, then it'll, you'll see a bubble come down, and it'll refill those little holes again. So it resupplies itself automatically by gravity.
How long do you leave it there?
Until it's empty. Or if I come back out and open up my hive, and I see that it's filling, I'll just take the cover off and refill it.
And you know, probably the first time that we go out and check is when we have a January thaw in the Midwest. Because that's the time that we want to make sure. We have the hives to see if they're heavy enough. If they're heavy enough, they most likely do not need feeding, because that means that they have enough honey in them. But if they're very, very light, the only way that we're going to keep them until the dandelions start blooming is to feed them falsely. Now, does this ever get turned into honey? No. It's just for them to feed themselves. And any, let's say they start laying about February 14th, the queen starts laying about February 14th.
It's like if you were in a service, you got the rat, called rations, ration food. When you're out on the battlefield, you can't open a can of stuff, you need to eat dried stuff.
And this doesn't freeze?
Well, we don't start feeding the liquid syrup until March.
And then you don't have that top cover on, you only have the...
We put an empty box around the feeder pail.
Okay.
We have a lot of spare boxes, so we just to protect that pail from the raccoon knocking it off, from the wind blowing it off, we have to put a square empty box over it, and then the cover on top of that. So it's protected from the elements. And if you really want to keep the room warm, you can wrap newspaper in there, crunch up newspaper, and do other things with it also. Keep it warm.
Next.
Yep, go ahead. That just shows the holes.
Okay.
This is another type of feeder. It fits in the hive. It actually replaces a frame. It's called a Portman feeder. But you can't see it real good, so we'll go on to the next one. Okay. Colonies are always started with 10 frames per box in the supers, but after the bees have worked in the hive for 1 year, we find out we can get more honey from 9 frames than we can out of 10. That sounds impossible, but the bees will draw fatter combs. It also makes us an easier job for us to uncap the honey to get the honey out of the combs. So it's an option you can choose to do. You can leave 10 in there. Or you can take down one and make your job a little easier come harvest time. But you can't do it the first year because you violate bee space. By the way, we're ready to get into, which we should have covered early, the inventor of the modern day beehive. The modern day beehive, as we see it here today, wasn't invented until 1850. And was invented by an Episcopalian priest in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, by the name of Lorraine Lorenzo Langstroth. So we still call these hives Langstroth hives today. And as you look at beekeeping, that's pretty modern, 1850. I mean, it sounds like a long time ago. But you remember the Greeks were keeping bees back 2500 BC, and they were keeping them in clay pots, straw hives, log hives, whatever they could find for a domicile. So this, we credit him with the invention, but he only invented this type of hive. He discovered something that no one ever knew before. And that is that bees need 3/8 of an inch of space between their combs. If you provide more than that, they make an extra unwanted layer of wax. If you have less than that, they can't navigate between their combs. So they refuse to make wax there. So he discovered 3/8 of an inch is the perfect amount of space for bees to navigate between their combs. And that's how he designed the first hive in the 10 frames. I could have had more, I could have had 10 or 12, but this was a comfortable size for me to use. So, we call these nine straw hives today, based on him.
Okay.
All right, next one. We always put rocks on the top of our hives. I don't have bears in most of my areas where I keep bees, but they're moving close. We have beehives in Wisconsin, and the bears are coming down along the Mississippi River. The young male bears are coming down. They're looking for mates because they're being driven off of the mating grounds. And so they come into a bee yard. They do lots of damage in the bee yard. We're getting close to giving up here.
Well, I'd like to go through all the bees with all the equipment.
That's
suction box comb, that we have a suction, actually some cut comb back there, maybe basket boxes, but this is a really, really hard one to do. I wouldn't suggest it for a first-year beekeeper, but it's something that gets a premium price, and you might want to consider it as you become a more seasoned beekeeper. Okay?
Entrance guards that we can put in the front to keep mice out. Skunks like to harass beehives, especially in the fall before they go into hibernation. They like to build up their body fat, and the skunk's mouth parts is so tough, if you want to do that at night, the guard bees come down and see what's knocking on their door, and then they snatch them up and eat them and pop
them. What is the animal you're talking about?
Skunk.
What is the animal? Oh, skunk. I thought you said
skunk.
Skunk's mouth.
Oh, skunks, yes.
Okay. They eat the bees, and they put on body fat, and they crawl in a hole and they hibernate.
But you can also see that this is going to keep that little mouse from getting in there too, can't you?
Yeah, they can't get that. They can't get through those holes.
Do raccoons get into?
Raccoons can be a problem.
Yes. But I mean, we've even had cow pastures where cows and deer, where a deer run is in one of our places, where deer have knocked over our hives. So we just have to kind of locate them.
Rats. Rats.
R-A-T, rat?
R-A-T, yes.
Wisconsin and Illinois don't have rats.
I have never had a problem with a rat. I've had problems with woodchucks. Everybody know what a woodchuck is? I don't know. It's a groundhog. Okay. I've had a problem with them, but they usually like to dig. They'll dig a hole underneath the hive and try to make themselves a little protection from the wind and the elements. So, now, bears are the very worst. And what do you think is the worst bear state for damaging beehives?
Washington.
Wisconsin.
It's a state you probably won't think of.
Colorado.
Montana.
Alaska.
Virginia.
Virginia
has more black bear issues with honeybees than any other state. I mean, all the states you said they all have bear issues. But Virginia has the most, and if you've ever hiked the Appalachian Trail or whatever, you want to do, every mile is a sign about be careful of bears. So anyways, bears are the biggest problem. You even have little bears that you sell, honey bears, to give credibility to the bear liking honey, okay? All right.
This is merely how we put them in. We can put a tag right there. Chuck, we have another photo. We're not going to put the pollination screen up. This is how we put them in for a winter. And it is a good idea to have some kind of a front closure.
The bees can get in and out.
Yeah, they
yes,
right
yes.
There.
You're so smart to say that. The bees can get in and out. Your question. How do you prevent bears from eating your honey?
Well, in fact, this is a good question because in Wisconsin, is it DNR?
Solar electric fences.
Yeah, they give you
solar power.
They will put up electric fences for you.
They'll pay, they'll give you money to buy the fencing and to buy the solar, a one-time deal.
Mm-hmm.
And they reimburse you for the cost of that to keep bears out. Bears don't make electricity in my house.
Only for one bee yard or for as many as you want?
Well, I don't know. We don't know.
Well, whatever, there's bear damage being done.
Yeah,
they have some guy, inspector, who comes out and says you're not faking it. And when a bear goes into a beehive, it's a shambles. They just eat the frames and just throw them all over the place. It looked like a tornado hit your eye. And and of course the bees are easy to damage, but they would treat it like that.
This is a hive tool, and this is not at all like the one that we have here. These are two brand new ones that are really nice, but a hive tool is probably one of our most important tools. It is like a hammer to a carpenter. Because remember what Chuck said to you about the propolis, real sticky. And so we need to go in there and pry the boxes apart, pry the frames out, and it's just our big thing. Please just pass this around and look at it. Okay, the next one.
Then bring a bees in today, but we wear white, we can. We wear light colored things so we don't look like a
bear.
And anything dark, you don't even want to call a pair of blue jeans or a black sweatshirt into your aviary. Because the bees will tell you that we don't like that color. we think you possibly could be related to a bear.
And I'm going to pass some pictures on while you continue talking about it.
So in the summer when it's real hot, I don't wear these, but when we harvest honey now, I wear those. It keeps my street clothes clean. They're just painter's overalls. You put them right over your street clothes, zipper up. We didn't bring a veil today, but I think there's a picture of the veil, right?
And I have a picture that I'm passing around of veils, yes. And there are pictures of
there's different kinds of veils. They got the New English beasts now that are a different type of design, you know, like Mars or something. They're all zippered into one. My knee veil is separate from the suit. A lot of them today want to have full protection. They have a zipper. The zipper's all around and comes back here. There's no way a bee can get into your outfit. Most people, and then gloves.
Here's the one this is only a half one. And that's cool.
It's just called a jacket. Yeah. And that's the English style.
Where it zippers on. That's virtually. But you know something? I have pictures later on that you'll see this week. We had 22 people in the bee yard one day on a Saturday, and now we were taking honey off, and that one person got stung. Bees have been bred for gentleness. So.
Karen would not hope. And back up. Karen would not work bees like this.
No, I but not so much. I wouldn't want them to get up here. To be honest, you know, go up my cuffs.
Cowboy boots or something.
Yeah.
There. And then boot bands. Yeah. Because bees, they find a little opening. They like to find in there and crawl in there. Well, I have bees. When they get to my knee, that's where I get worried. Mm-hmm. I got to smell them, you know. I got to tell them. They're in a dangerous position.
Well, he's poorly protected from bees.
That's my bee veil. It's his little different style. I'm not wearing a red shirt. That's because he stays in there. Mm-hmm. They say bees don't see red. It looks like white.
I think this one is a hard hat, and this one's a hat.
That one you're supposed to wear the baseball helmet with a hat. Okay, that's a different type. Bee gloves, protect your hands, your
first
arms.
First thing that you get rid of.
Yeah, when you feel comfortable with bees, you shut their gloves. We burn pine straw in our smokers. Nice sweet smell. You can use corn cobs, wood shavings, rotted bark, corn husks, anything that has a nice sweet smell. I used to know a guy who had an auto shop. He had beehives and used to throw oily bags in there.
Oh, they're great. They ignite right away.
But the bees don't like it because they come right out stinging. Smoking oil on a rag is not what you want to use for a nice sweet smell in the beehive. Okay.
Next one.
This is just we trap pollen and we sell bee pollen. This shows you our trapping mechanism. We're going to cover that anymore.
There's some pollen back in the paper.
Yes, and there also is another picture that shows how the pollen basket grows in. Let's go to the next one.
Is that a little screen thing?
This is actually.
There's a box in here.
Yeah, this is a three-step thing. First of all, this is put in, the bottom is closed off, forcing the bees to come and go.
They have to find the new entrance.
And then, this is a drawer that goes in.
Drop the box in first.
Yeah, what do you call this?
Cheese box.
Yes, you put the box in then, and then this is put in. The bees are made to go over a screen where the pollen on their little legs scrapes into the screen. It falls into here. We take that out on a daily basis, dry it, and then clean it because it does have bee wings and everything in it, and bee legs, and then sell it.
It's a great value-added product. People are using bee pollen for health. Strengthens your immune system. If you have allergies, you take a little bit of it. You can help immunize yourself.
So is it optional to catch the pollen?
Oh, yeah.
And you don't want to do it all the time.
I would not suggest the beginning beekeeper do that. We're just showing the things that you can do to expand your market. These are all possible things. The basic things that we did here, you will have to have. Okay? Go to the next one.
Yeah, next one.
Pollination screens, we move bees, we pound in apple orchards, sunflowers, blueberries. It's hot summer, we have to move our bees, we ventilate the tops. We take all the outer covers off, and we just put a screen on the top. And we shove this in the front door. You know, we go out in the early morning, 4 o'clock before sun up, or in the evening, and we'll shove this right in the front door of the hive. And it's hardware cloth, it's like a soldered wire screen. And it closes off the front of the hive, allows the bees to ventilate the hive, but they can't fly out while we're moving the bees. Bees fly out going down the road on the highway. If they're further than 2 miles from their hive, they're lost souls. They can't find their way back. So I don't want to lose any of my bees. Plus, the guy I'm bringing my bees into, he's paying me to bring this hive in there. He's paying me $60 to have this hive set in his orchard for about 3 weeks. And we'll move 50 in. So it's $3,000 I make in 1 day with these bees. I'm working them overtime. I'm not worried about any honey, because all the honey they make from the apple orchard and the blueberry farm is all going to be turned into baby bees. We aren't going to store surplus at that early in the year. And when I get them back and put them on summer pasture, they will then start making the honey that I'll harvest. These are two skyscraper hives that I had. Each of those hives produced over 250 pounds of honey. Now you can do the math. I sell my honey for $6.50 a pound. $1,300 once the hive. Now they are all like that.
Okay.
Those are hot.
We have about 3 minutes left, so we have to kind of...
Ways of getting the bees out of the hive. This is the bee escape board. If you didn't want to use any chemicals, you can use this bee escape board. It's a maze. If you know what a maze is? Mm-hmm. The bees, you put this on the hive. You put your supers above this little hole. They go down. They go through this maze, and they cannot figure how to get back up there into the upper boxes that I want to take off. A neat little thing designed by Brushy Mountain Bees down in Monrovian Falls, North Carolina. And I just bought one and made one for myself. It's their design. I'm not selling them, so I'll make them for myself. It's just a piece of plywood and some other stuff. Some screed wire. Okay, next one.
That's it. That's it.
Here
next one. How do you use a bee escape?
You
put it down, it's like
a maze. I'll show them how to.
Okay,
go
next one, I guess.
Okay. Medication. We aren't going to go into that today, so next one. That's a nuke box. We make up small beehives. They only hold 4 frames instead of 10. They're called nukes because it's short for the word nucleus. They are a nucleus, or they're a baby beehive that will eventually become a full beehive when it gets big enough. We can get it into a big box, but we can buy nukes and transfer them to bigger equipment. So that's one of the ways of buying bees. Candy board. We have to feed our bees in the winter. We put rock candy on them. This is boiled to 240, a sugar solution, and then we pour it into these boards, and it hardens like rock candy. How many people eat rock candy when you're a kid? Okay. Well, that's what that's like. And the bees come up on it, and all the heat from the cluster is rising, and it gets onto that, and that moisture of those bees' heat makes that candy board real sticky and gooey, almost like a taffy apple. And they're able to metabolize that sticky, gooey substance in the winter and stay alive. That's if we don't have enough honey in the hive and we can't feed syrup because it's too cold. So we put those on around Thanksgiving and take them off about the 1st of March, if the colony needs it. Uncapping honey. These are hot knives and scratchers.
And when we talk about extracting, we will show more how to use these, if that's okay.
Yeah. I'm uncapping there.
And this is an uncapping basket here. And this
extracting machine.
Now, that is a problem if you're just a beginning beekeeper. This is a rather expensive thing to buy. I'm guessing $600, give or take a few. Probably your best deal is to rent or to get a bee club that will lend you
their. I use this one myself, and then I rent it out to beginning beekeepers. And they have a beekeeping honey harvesting party. Mm-hmm. So 4 or 5 beekeepers, newbies, just started. It's $35 for the hot knife, the whole works, the capping basket. They have a nice little party on them Saturday afternoon. They extract all their honey. And it's only called $35 for all 4 parties. Well, some people do it themselves.
They haul their boxes in.
No, they come and get the extractor from me.
Uh-huh.
And they do it on their site. Uh-huh. They're responsible for getting the bees out of their boxes. They take care of all that. They're responsible for bringing the extractor back all cleaned up with hot soapy water. And everything clean like they found it when they. And, you know, I would never tell a beginning person to buy an extractor the first year. You're just throwing your money away. You know, you don't know if you're going to like this that long. You could rent my extractor for 10 years and still not come up with the cheapest junky extractor you'd be able to buy. For $350, you can extract your honey for 10 years using my equipment. And the $350 extractor isn't much of an extractor.
I was just wondering how an extractor works.
It's a centrifuge. It's like a merry-go-round. Uh-huh. Well, can you go back? See, each of these here is looking down into the thing. We put our frames in. The frames would set. They set down in those pockets.
So that's actually quite big then, if it all.
This big.
Six frames.
And they fit the task anyway.
One, two, three, four, five.
They fit down all.
Oh.
And then on top there's a speed wheel, and you turn the speed to start slow. Because if you start fast, boom, it'll blow out. You start slow, and let the frame start unloading its honey load. And then as it starts unloading the honey, the honey will go to the sides of the cake and run to the bottom, and there's a draw valve. You draw it off, there's pieces of wax, it might be a dead bee or something that got in there. We have to strain that out, okay? And then I kick my speed up a little bit. Till eventually, when I'm near the end, it's revving wider. I get almost 99.9% of the honey out of those foams. Then the foams are still wet and sticky. But there's honey still coming in the field, I come back out to the bee garden and I put that honey box back on. I might get a second crop. I might get a second crop of goldenrod honey, which is our fall honey. Clover alfalfa is done. Now I'm going to go for the fall honey. A lot of people like goldenrod honey. It's got a real butterscotchy flavor. It's darker in color, very pungent smelling, and people feel it's great. A more helpful honey than just a little mild white sun honey. Okay? Bee brush. You can brush the bees off if you want. You can use a fume board. Next one. What's this?
Blower.
Leaf blower or bee blower. We can blow the bees out. We don't want to bring the bees back home with us. It's a trap. We want them all to be back at the beehive. When bees get feel wind, they don't get angry. They just think a big windstorm is around their hive. You blow them right out in front of the hive, they go right back in and do it fine. Okay? They go right back in the hive.
So, I don't know if you're going to talk about this in one of the future classes, but like I live in an urban setting, and is it possible, I mean, you're moving these around the orchards and to alfalfa fields and stuff. Is it possible to do this in an urban setting? Or
yes.
Indeed it is.
But you know, with me, we live in a house, a lot that's 52 by 145. And the house and the garage take up almost all a lot, and we have all of our bees in our yards. Forest reserves, people that say, oh, man, you work with a guy that says, hey, we got 3-4 acres, move one out by our house, share some of the honey with us. You can't believe how many people wouldn't mind having a beehive, especially if they're gardeners.
Yeah.
They'd say, oh, man, they'd go for a beehive on their property.
But the city is one of the better places of actually getting honey because you don't have all the pesticides and things like that that you have out in corn country and soybean country and golf course country.
Do you need a permit?
Each of your cities is going to tell you a different story. Chicago allows you to keep rooftop and backyard and hives. Oak Park, Illinois, which is a very nice suburb of Chicago, allows you to keep it, but they say you can only keep two hives. You can also keep hens, chickens in town.
You have so many feet from the fence line,
yes,
you have to provide water.
Provide water so that they don't visit your neighbor's swimming pool. You know that.
That's no guarantee at all. Wherever they start drinking, they always go back to drinking. It's like having your favorite.
But
tavern.
Yes, but you do need to check with your city. And we have something back there, by the way, that if you would like any of our printouts, we will email them to you. One of them is
being a good neighbor.
Being a good neighbor, yes. And we really want you to be a good neighbor. You know, we don't want you to challenge your neighbor next door by putting a hive right in front of their garage or something like that, or their kids place it, you know.
You want beekeeping to be a happy hobby for you. You don't want to agitate your neighbors. You don't want to have to go through litigation. It's always better to look at all your avenues of where my hive can go. And I always tell people, conceal your hives. There's no sense in advertising you have a beehive in here. Put it behind the fence, put it behind your garden shed, put it where the bees have to fly up across a shrub. You don't want the bees flying a pedestrian head across the neighbor's yard where the kids are playing badminton or something, you know?
So another question. You live in about a
well, you're a good distance.
Yeah.
When bees begin to forage, we're going to talk about that tomorrow. The last 6 weeks of their life, they're foragers. They do all the outdoor activities, and once you leave the beehive, it's very wet for the bee. Dangerous. It's in the confines of your house. If you stay home all the time, are you ever going to get hurt in a traffic accident? No. With bees, once they leave that hive, there's thunderstorms, there's windstorms, there's tornadoes, there's semi-trucks going down the road, there's purple martins, there's kingbirds.
And you can step on them in the clover.
You step on them in the clover. You know, all those perils are out there. So when the bee gives its life to the hive and eventually it wears its wings out, dies in the field, it's the very most dangerous job it does in its lifetime, is gathering honey and pollen.
And if it stings you, it dies.
And
and it eats things that die. So it gives us life for protection over time.
Yes. Do you have to be concerned about too many hives in a certain area? Like
yes.
If we have neighbors that have hives, that type of thing?
A lot of it is going to depend on the kind of forage that you have in your area. We have our hives out in a forest preserve where there are acres and acres and acres of wildflowers.
Plus wetlands. Wetlands.
Wetlands. Mm-hmm. You know, that is not a problem. But if your neighbor has 10 hives and you have 10 hives, and there's nothing but corn and soybeans around you, that's not going to fly.
It's location, location, location.
So how do
we
you
scout
that?
How many hives do you need right now?
They come in seasonally for the orchards in our area, and then they go with
that. Oh, you probably have enough.
And talk to somebody around your area. Where do you live?
In Michigan.
Michigan, yeah. Michigan is a good honey state, too. With
do you know where they're coming from? Are they coming out of Florida?
Well, I know there's a big grower that does take into Florida and then come back, but I don't know if this specific ones are from that.
I've had new beekeepers, and this is my heart, it's a trouble thing to tell them, but they put in hives right next to a guy with a cucumber farm, pickle farm, mm-hmm. Michigan. And their hives were all infested with the small hive beetles because mm-hmm. the guy bringing them to Florida brought the small hive beetles. Another mm-hmm. terrible parasite. Sending tank for pails. We put all of our honey in food grade buckets, 60 pound pails. Honey weighs 12 pounds to a gallon, water weighs 8. So it's tapping in heavier than water. Very viscous material, okay? Cut it. The strainer honey. These are paint strainer bags from Home Depot. They work great. They're nylon, food grade nylon, and you can use them over and over and over again. If you want to really fine filter honey, put two bags together in a pail, put a rubber band around it, pour the honey in there, and then pull the bags up. Let it drip for a day or two, and you got really, really crystal clear honey. Well, some people don't like their honey crystal clear. They want a few dead bees in there, a few wings. And you maybe seen some honey on a store shelf. You ever seen honey like that? We have a guy marketing in the Midwest. It's full of junk at the top. I would never buy that honey, but there's people flock to it, and he gets twice the price.
Because it's natural.
Because it's totally naturally raw honey.
That's what I'm getting. In other words, less
I'd say totally naturally unsanitary honey. You're doing a disservice for the product. Because honey is such a perceived product. Why would you want to put all the garbage in?
In fact, the way that our honey comes out, it's so clear, he almost would have to go in and spoon the crud out of a
spoon. And throw it in the jar.
And throw it in the jar. That's
yeah, I mean, it's
no idea how it gets.
But there are people like that. There are people get in these tangents. They think it's got, that's the good stuff.
How many more are left here? Not, there can't be too many. Oh,
we don't want to go into this. We'll do this the last
day. Let's talk about this the last day, because I don't want to keep you people, but we're here to answer.
We want to ask, because there's some very good questions, and I would like to hear some more.
But do feel free, by the way. You're not going to make us feel badly if you get up and leave. Honestly, you're okay.
Okay, what's tomorrow?
Okay, tomorrow is starting your first hive. And we're going to also, I have a little bit of a PowerPoint, just a teeny little one tomorrow, about going and picking up our bees and then installing them.
We show you how the truckloads come in from California.
Yeah. That's kind of a fun
with one. $250 million of the bees sometimes.
And if you've heard of the
we want a lot of bee wrecks. You hear about bee trucks getting wrecked.
Highways.
We're talking lots of money involved in the bee wreck. And so normally bee trucks coming across the United States like that will have two drivers. They don't even stop to sleep over at night. They sleep in the cab, they have sleeper cabs, and they take turns driving. The only thing they stop for is fuel. The truck has to have fuel to make it to Watertown, Wisconsin, where we pick up our bees. They leave Glen, California, north of Fresno, in the almond honey producing area of California, and they drive 42 hours straight, nonstop, to central Wisconsin. And then we got beekeepers from all over Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, Ohio, and Illinois, all. It's really something to see. All these guys coming in their small trucks, my small pickup, just loading up crazy bees for people who want to start a beehive.
Oh, is that the trucks we have then?
You can start bees by catching a swarm, too.
I mean,
but that's not always a guarantee.
You'd have to be in the right.
The best way is to catch a package.
Tell them that this is in the bookstore, by the way.
Where is that?
This is in the bookstore here.
Oh, Beekeeping for Dummies. Great book. The book that I use. Starting Right with Bees is the one I use. And I use it for my beginning classes.
And we have a lot of other books there. We'll talk a little bit more about them later, but... And we'll be going through our picture cards tomorrow and talking all about the different status of the bees, the queen, the drone, the workers, and the work that they do. So thanks for coming today. If there's no more questions, we're done. And we'll see you back tomorrow. We'll see if I find this interesting. We are interested in it. We and also get a lot of other people involved with it. And I want to tell you one more thing about bees. They are endangered. We need more beekeepers. Beekeepers are the last line of defense to keep these insects around. Even the little bit you can do with your few hives in your garden is something big in the beekeeping world. And we are getting a lot of beekeepers today because a lot of people have this Ecclesiastes zeal. They think that if they get involved, that they can have something to say. And it's a good feeling to do that, that you're doing something for nature, okay? So I think it's you'll find it fun and a very interesting hobby to get involved with. But we're giving you all the insight.
Did you see the movie
Queen of the Sun? Yes, Queen of the Sun, great. Right? There's a lot of great movies out there on beekeeping.
Yeah.
Queen of the Sun. It made it to the fine arts theaters. We didn't get to all the theaters in the summer.